If you're still there, you might just want to hang around in 1 Timothy chapter 6. We'll be using this primarily as our passage for the morning as we think about it. And as you turn back there, let me take you back to the 1980s, if you indeed lived during the 1980s. And you might remember a number of things. And one of the sadder things was the so-called rise and fall of the televangelist. You remember a number of people, number of men who made a career out of TV preaching, built great empires, really, so to speak. But you might also remember that one by one by one, these men were found to be frauds. They were either deceiving their followers, involved in all kinds of scandal, some of them involved in cheating on their wives, and one by one, they began to fall. 1 Timothy chapter 6 was written to these kinds of men. Those who would use their position in Christ as a means of gain. And so because of that thirst for money, that thirst for wealth, they fell. And thus, as the Apostle Paul advises Timothy, here a young man who is just on the cusp of a lifetime of preaching, he says to him, you must be very careful about that love of money. And what's so interesting is, oftentimes we forget in 1 Timothy chapter 6, this is primarily written to men who preach the gospel. Beware of what wealth can do to you. That being said, it's not alone for men who preach. The principles that we find within it are the warnings for any of us, but more important than that, the Apostle Paul says, I'm going to give you the keys of understanding how to be wealthy. I'm going to tell you exactly what it means to have real wealth. Now, there might be some men who would introduce a sermon this way and then start giving you a lot of economic advice, how to handle your debts and how to pay your bills and make more money. That's not the purpose of this sermon. The purpose of this sermon is to understand what the apostle is telling us in verse 6. When he says this, there is great gain in godliness with contentment. As we think about our theme for this year, partakers of the divine nature, one of the facets of that is the idea of godliness. And this morning, I want us to tie that idea in of what godliness combined with wealth will do for us. And so, as we begin thinking about that, let's think about a monetary term that the Apostle Paul uses. Here, in a couple of different ways, he talks about gain. So we have to ask ourselves the question right away, is which gain is of real interest to us? And this is a question that each of us, as individuals, must answer. We think about those men to whom Paul was writing about here, those false teachers. These were men who were not preachers trying to get along. They were not men who were just trying to earn enough to feed their families. These were men interested in much more than earning a living. They were interested in what we would classify as wealth. Now, if you remember your basic economics class, wealth is what you have left over when all the bills are paid. It's not the income, what's coming in and going out. It's the amount of money that's left after all of that. And so as the apostle talks about these men, he says, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. The riches, the wealth is what they were after. And so those who were once perhaps faithful to God, perhaps once they were on the road of teaching the truth, they had left the way of truth and had gone on a treasure hunt. And thus the apostle adds in verse 10, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through these cravings that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. So here's our choice. Do we go down the road of monetary wealth? If that's our temptation, we need to understand that when we think about money, we're thinking about something very, very dangerous. Oftentimes, we tend to try to shroud this a little bit. And so we start talking about money, and we know Christians perhaps who are quite wealthy, and there's a fear of offending those who have money. And so we say something to the effect of, well, we know lots of Christians who have lots of money, and they're some of the most faithful people we know. Absolutely right. Some of the best people I've known have been very successful. Sometimes we come to a passage like this and we say, well, now remember, it's not money, it's the love of money. It's the attitude that we have toward it that gives us trouble. Yes, I agree with that. But none of this negates the point that when we are dealing with money, we are dealing with danger. I might compare it to this for some odd, peculiar, strange reason. There are people who like to keep snakes as pets. I don't know why. But they'll have some big boa constrictor, and that's the family pet. And people get in this crazy idea that that boa constrictor loves them. You know, just like a little puppy or a cat or something. You know, just loves them, and they let their guard down. And they wake up one night just to find how much that boa constrictor loves them as it's giving them the squeeze of death. Well, is there anything wrong with keeping an exotic pet? No. However, you better make sure it's in a good cage. And you better make sure that the lock is checked every day on that cage because there is danger there. May I say it's the same thing with wealth, with money. There is a danger in it. And part of the danger is the fact that it gives us a very false sense of security. I think this is why the writer of Hebrews says, keep your life free from the love of money. Why? Because it makes us feel something that's not there. Consider something Jesus said. He said, when you think about money, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. He says there is no security in it. Something else that causes us trouble concerning money is not only that false sense of security, sometimes it leads us to a false sense of superiority, of thinking because we are successful in this world's goods, somehow that puts us on a level higher than everybody else. And if here's a guy over here who's having to work day to day and doesn't always have quite enough money at the end of the month, we're a little bit better. We better be careful of that. In fact, we find where Paul says a little bit later in this chapter, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty. He lays it on the line, doesn't he? He says there's a danger with wealth. There's a danger in making it think you're better than everybody else. And he adds with that, don't set your hope on the uncertainty of riches. We also find that a danger in wealth, that a danger in money, is that it very much can lead us to discontentment. Even in our reading this morning, at the very end of it, the latter part of verse 10, the apostle says, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith, and what? And pierced themselves with many pangs. Let me tell you, let's not ever kid ourselves in thinking, well, if we have lots of money, it's no real temptation for us. There's no real problem there. God, in specific terms, says, be careful. Don't allow it to lead you to believe something that is not true. Now, he contrasts that view of wealth with what's the right view of wealth. He says, let me tell you about what true wealth is. And the whole point that Paul is making here in 1 Timothy 6 is you cannot measure real wealth with a dollar sign. You cannot look at this and say, because I have this much money and this much in the bank, that somehow I'm secure and I'm better and I am content. He says that's not the case. It's this kind of wealth that the child of God is looking for. It's this kind of wealth that we're seeking. You remember what he says in verse 6? He says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. When we look at that passage, I want you to pay particular attention to Paul's usage of the word great. Like so many good words, they can be so overused, to the point that they lose their effectiveness. What we talk about, having a great ball game, a great day at work, a great night out on the town. We talk about great in a very common way. You will never find God in His recorded word flinging the word great around in some casual common way. It's a special word. It's to indicate something far superior than anything we find in day-to-day life. And so Paul makes the point here in using that word that when we combine godliness with contentment, it will not only be our gain, our wealth, it will be great in what the Lord provides for us. So this great gain then is seizing the important concept of godliness when it's found with contentment. So let's take a minute and talk about that. What does it mean to be content? Well, there's a lot of ideas about it, and I want us to talk about a couple of those, but just plainly stated, if you look it up in any everyday dictionary, what you're going to find is the definition of contentment is actually self-sufficiency. Now, that sounds a little contradictory, doesn't it? Here God spends a vast amount of the Bible talking about trusting in Him, and we think about passages such as lean not on your own understanding and the like. And all of a sudden we're saying God is saying to really find wealth, we find contentment and self-sufficiency. Well, we need to pause for a minute and we need to talk about that a bit. Why is it we can be self-sufficient? Well, for the child of God, the reason that this real contentment can occur is because of who is making the decisions for us. You see, we're self-sufficient, not in the sense of saying, I have the answer for everything that comes along. It's saying that the God I serve can take care of me. Let me illustrate that with something the Apostle Paul said to the Galatians. He said, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. You know what the apostle is saying? He's saying, the day I was baptized into Christ, there was a time for an obituary. The old man, Saul of Tarsus, died away. Paul is dead, and in his place, Christ now lives. And what the apostle is saying in very real terms is, now I am allowing Christ to make the decisions. I'm allowing Christ to guide me in my ways. By understanding His Word, by understanding His message, I let Him live in me. And you see, when you and I come to the point where we are allowing Christ to live in us, we can be self-sufficient because the self is Jesus. He's the one who's guiding us. And then we link that with the idea of godliness. We've discussed godliness quite a bit this month, both in sermon, bulletin articles that we've had. But let me just remind you that godliness is simply defined as piety and devotion to God. It means I don't lean on my own understanding. It means in every way I acknowledge God and trust in Him. And so here Paul is really looking at two different aspects of the same thing. Contentment is trust in God. Godliness is trust in God. And when I put those together, I am allowing God to run my life. I'm allowing Him to make the decisions for me. Now, we have to be awfully careful because there are a lot of false ideas out there about contentment. Contentment, I am convinced, is one of the most misunderstood concepts. I decided to try a little experiment in preparing for this lesson, and it worked. That's why I'm including it here. I said I'm going to go to Google, and I'm going to go to images, and I'm going to type in the word contentment, and I'm going to put the four human pictures that come up first. And I also had to enclose one with a cat since it's 2016, since cats have to be on everything. You want to see how the world thinks about contentment? I'm going to tell you, that's not contentment. That's basically laziness, might be a good word. Carefreeness. You look at the scenes that mankind says, when we think about the word contentment, this is what comes to mind. I assure you, when you put that word up against what the Bible says about contentment, a very different picture emerges. Let's look at that picture because the Apostle Paul tells us about it. And the idea that we're going to see in him is that godliness is really true gain only when it's independent of circumstances. In other words, I don't know who this quote is from, but he got it exactly right, or she got it exactly right, in saying, look, if you want to understand what contentment is, you got to understand it has nothing to do with the circumstances going on. Look at that illustrated. Now that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. That's the picture of contentment. Paul says, I've been full, I've been hungry, I've been rich, I've been poor. He goes on in other places. I've been stoned, I've been shipwrecked. And he says, in all of these, I can be content because independent of whatever circumstance I'm in, whatever it looks like on the surface, I know God is with me. And I know God is going to get me through whatever it is. That's content. And the apostle also teaches us that this is a life learning lesson. It is not something that we come to and we master it and we can move on. You'll recall when Paul prayed to have that thorn of the flesh removed, God said to him, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now listen to what Paul said. He said, therefore I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content. Content how? With weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. I tell you, that's a hard, hard lesson. Can you imagine not knowing where your next meal's coming from? People trying to kill you. People saying all manner of rumors and hateful things about you. And to be able to say, I'm at peace, I'm content, because Christ lives in me. It's a lesson the Apostle Paul had to work on. And it's a lesson we must work on as well. Now let's pull all this back together. So when we think about gain, and we think about godliness, and we think about contentment, how do we get to that point of building that treasure that God is telling us about, that contentment that is great gain in godliness? Well, it's first of all, understanding that God must be heeded. So why do I say that? I say that because the world around us is telling us a very, very different message. You turn on a television program, and I think roughly of a 30-minute program, 10 to 15 minutes of that now is in advertisements. I can almost assure you there's going to be one of those advertisements that's going to tell you about financial security. It's going to tell you who to invest with, how to invest, who not to trust, who to trust. One of, I suppose, the most ironic ones that we have going now is the need to buy gold. Because gold represents the safe investment. Read your Bible. What does God say about trusting in gold? It is the exact opposite of what everybody on the advertisements are saying. You can be secure if you've got gold in your portfolio. You can be secure if you've got this stock or that stock or this amount in the bank. I'm not saying we can't plan ahead. I'm not saying we don't need to look toward retirement. What I'm talking about here, though, is the idea of trusting that, of thinking that's what my security is all about. God says, be awfully careful. And He says the first step in that is controlling your desire, is making sure that you're not craving and thirsting that as your gain, as your wealth. There's a proverb that speaks so aptly to this. Proverbs 23, when you sit down to eat with a ruler, observe carefully what is before you and put a knife to your throat if you are given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist When your eyes light on it, it is gone, for suddenly it sprouts wings flying like an eagle toward heaven. That's a very poetic way of saying, don't trust in what you got. Don't let that be the source of your security. He says we've got to be discerning. We've got to be able to stay away from that kind of thing. Because just as surely as you trust in it, like an eagle taking flight, it's going to be gone, never to be seen again. Controlling desire is the first step. Trusting God, though, is the ultimate step. Allowing God to have that control in our lives. And that's going to be reflected in how we use our physical prosperity. If I'm saying everything's got to be put back for a rainy day or for my retirement, and I'm never using it for the service of God, indeed, I am trusting in my wealth in a physical sense. So let's think about what God says. What does He tell us is the wealth formula? Let's revisit a couple of passages we started. You remember we talked about Jesus saying, don't trust, don't put it in earthly treasures. Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. There's the lesson. Christ is saying to us, you must put your treasure where it's really secure. Let me ask you, what's going to happen to every penny you have? And it may happen before you die. Does the government have a pretty good ability to come in and take a chunk of that away from you? Can a thief break into your account now and perhaps somewhere on the other side of the world with a push of a computer button empty your account, take over your identity? Let me tell you, what Jesus spoke in the first century is as true in the 21st as it's ever been. Therefore, He says, don't trust in physical wealth. Lay up for yourselves that treasure in heaven. Remember Hebrews 13:5. We looked at the first part. Keep your life free from the love of money. And what? And be content with what you have. For He has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? God provides something wealth never can. God says, I'll never disappear. I'll never be taken from you. I'll never leave you. That's what God can do. And thus God says the success in all of this is not trusting in uncertainty, but trusting in Him. Well, let me add one final part of this wealth formula of God. And that's understanding the need to invest wisely. The person who's kind of savvy with earthly wealth doesn't keep it tucked in a mattress. The person is taking that money and using it to make more money, using that gain to bring further gain. Spiritually speaking, that's what God tells us to do. God says you need to allow spiritual gain to be put to work. Consider something that He says on down in 1 Timothy chapter 6. He says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. We looked at that part. Who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Listen to verse 18. For they are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, echoing Jesus, verse 19, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future so they may take hold of that which is truly life. God is saying to us, when I bless you with physical wealth, that is not for you to sit around and use for some kind of false comfort. It's for you to put to work. And He specifically targets those who are rich here. And I dare say that all of us in this room, considering where we live in the world right now, we put ourselves in this category. And He says, you take that and do good with good works, and you show generosity and you share. It's a picture that He presents of never fearing the loss of physical gain, when there is spiritual gain that can be accomplished. And thus we think about what the apostle says can happen. He says physical wealth can turn us inward. It can make us too concerned about us as individuals. Spiritual wealth will turn us outward. It'll make us concerned about those around us, of using whatever blessing God has given for the service of others. And if I may include one final passage, I think we can see the illustration of what God is going to do when we allow Him to be our trust. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 11, the apostle says, the point is this: whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. As it is written, He has distributed freely, He has given to the poor, His righteousness endures forever. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way, to be generous in every way, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. That's where we need to be. People who have been blessed, and who in turn use that as a blessing for others. Not for self-glory or adulations of men, but to glorify and honor the God who is the owner of all of this stuff anyway. So as you and I think about the idea of godliness and contentment being great gain, let me ask you something. What's in your heavenly wallet? What kind of treasure are you storing up for the days to come? Are you building that foundation? You see, wealth is an awfully dangerous thing. Money can deceive us. In fact, there's an old hymn. We don't hear it a lot anymore. Every once in a while, it's led. First verse says, not all earth's gold and silver can make a sinner whole. What shall it profit thee, O man, if thou shouldst lose thy soul? That's the message Paul told to Timothy. And that's the message Paul told to us. This past week, four young people understood what true wealth is all about. And my prayer for them is that they never forget that. That they always remember where the true treasures really are. And by their example, they have shown others in this room who also need to be thinking about that, to understand where true treasures really are. And so here's the question. When we get to the end of our lives here, which do we want? A big bank account that our children will fight over? Or do we want the kind of security that when we breathe our last breath, we can be confident that God is going to say, well done, good and faithful servant, you built a foundation on great gain.